From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Rob Foreman Dew writes novels about the intricacies of family life. She thought she had pretty much navigated past the most hazardous part of her own family journey until her son told her he's gay. On today's Fresh Air, Rob Foreman Dew tells us how she handled one of the biggest, most devastating surprises of her life. It's the subject of her new memoir, The Family Heart. Also, what are the qualities of a good leader? We talked to Gary Wills about his new book, Certain Trumpets, The Call of Leaders. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his previous book, which analyzed Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And Stephen Schiff reviews Spike Lee's new movie, Crooklyn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate has voted to require President Clinton to unilaterally lift the arms embargo on the Bosnian government, but the bill has contradictory orders. Another part of the legislation directs Mr. Clinton to seek help from U.S. allies before lifting the embargo. Another final vote is expected later today. The president says he wants to lift the ban, but not without the help and the approval of the United Nations. Congress has sent Mr. Clinton a new bill that imposes prison terms and fines on anti-abortion activists who threaten or use violence at abortion clinics. The Senate passed the bill today by a vote of 69-30. The House passed it last week. President Clinton is expected to sign it. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah says the law will be a weapon against anti-abortion activists engaged in peaceful civil disobedience. President Clinton says he won't rush to make a decision on who to nominate for the Supreme Court. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president said 2 days ago that he will announce his decision on who should replace outgoing Justice Harry Blackmun within 2 days. But Mr. Clinton said today he's taking his time to make his decision because he knows that it will have implications for years and decades to come.
So I'm going to attempt to do what I did last time, even against all the pressure of time deadlines, and that's to make a really good decision that I feel good about.
Mr. Clinton reminded reporters that his selection of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg came after a similarly deliberative process, and he promised, "You won't have to wait much longer." Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt is reported to be the top contender. If Babbitt is selected, the administration would be required to name a new cabinet member. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The commander of the Rwandan government army says he is ready to accept an expanded United Nations force of peacekeepers as long as it limits its work to protecting humanitarian operations. The leader of the rebel forces has made a similar comment. The BBC's Mark Doyle reports.
General Bizimungu said he accepted the proposed increase in the UN presence as long as it was a dissuasive military mission rather than an intervention force. The general said offensive actions, such as those undertaken by the UN in Somalia, would not be acceptable. The agreement of both military commanders to the proposed increase was announced separately in the presence of the UN commander in Rwanda, General Romeo Dallaire. General Dallaire has proposed two options for the Security Council in New York to consider, one of a total of 5,500 and a second of 8,000 troops. Under both options, the peacekeepers would assist humanitarian aid by escorting convoys and protecting vulnerable civilians.
Mark Doyle reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 17 points at 3,646. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up more than 2 points at 719.20. This is NPR. The government says wholesale prices fell 0.1% in April. That's the best performance so far this year. The Labor Department says both food and energy prices were down. The Producer Price Index measures inflationary pressures before they get to consumers. Wholesale prices have fallen 0.4% in the last 12 months. Meanwhile, the government says retail sales were also down 0.8% in April. That is the second decline in 4 months. Analysts say that's because Easter arrived early this year and many holiday sales came in March. Iraq's deputy prime minister is expected to meet privately today with members of the United Nations Security Council. Tariq Aziz is trying to convince them to lift UN sanctions imposed after Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait. Linda Fasulo reports.
Tariq Aziz is in New York for a week-long visit Today, he's expected to meet with individual council members, including Council President Ibrahim Gambari of Nigeria and the French ambassador. Tomorrow, he's scheduled for talks with Ralphie Kayas, chairman of a special commission overseeing the dismantling of Baghdad's weapons of mass destruction. UN disarmament efforts are now moving into a new phase of putting in place and then testing a long-term monitoring program to ensure Baghdad does not rearm. Once that is accomplished, the prospects for allowing Iraq to export oil increase. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, the Council's regular 60-day review of sanctions will take place, but no change is expected. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
Lawyers for Rodney King are appealing a lower court's ruling on the time they have to cross-examine witnesses. King is suing the city of Los Angeles for the beating he suffered 3 years ago at the hands of city police. The judge hearing the case has put time limits on both sides to keep the trial moving, and King's lawyers have appealed. King has already won $4 million in compensatory damages. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Novelist Rob Formandoux's territory is the family. Her first novel, Dea Love Sophie to Death, was about the world's last happy family. It won the 1982 American Book Award. Her next novel, The Time of Her Life, was about how family members unconsciously hurt each other. In her third novel, Fortunate Lives, she returned to the happy family of her first novel, only to disrupt their lives with the death of the youngest son in a car crash. Now Rob Formandoux tells part of her own story in her new memoir, The Family Heart. It's about how her life was changed when her older son, Stephen, told her he is gay. The revelation first threw her into a state of grief, but that was transformed into anger at a society which could discriminate against her son. When her son broke the news, he was a sophomore at Yale, home on a break. This is how he came out.
Well, he was on the phone, talking to a girl I thought he was involved with, a young woman. And suddenly I simply said, I realized there was no sexual tension between them, as you hear between adolescents. And I said, have you been involved with anybody since high school? He was a sophomore. And he looked very irritated by the question, as he should have. It was absolutely none of my business. And he said, there's something I've been meaning to tell you. And I listened for a minute. And he said, I think I might be gay. And a parent doesn't want to hear that because there's a huge range of things that happen to you after you get this information. And I tried to change what he said. I said, oh, you think you might be gay? And he said, no, what I mean is I am gay. And we took it from there. I gave him a hug. He gave me a hug. And we moved on. That was the beginning of a long process. Not too long, but longer than it should have been. Longer than I hope it'll be for anybody else.
It sounds like you have a pretty tight-knit family. But did it make you feel, when your son came out, did it make you feel like maybe you didn't really know him at all? And
absolutely.
Did it change your image of him?
No. It didn't change my image of him, but I think this is particular to each family. I did feel foolish on one level that I had not. This is a person, and along with his brother, whom I thought I knew better than any other creature in the world. I thought I knew everything about him. I don't mean intimate details. I didn't think I knew. I didn't want to know who he was dating, or I no wanted to know. But it was, I knew what wasn't my business, but I thought I knew everything essential to his happiness. And here was this enormous burden of secrecy he had carried in order to make us happy as parents, and that broke my heart.
You know, you had an image of him as being someone who was just beloved by everybody. He did
golden.
Great in school. He, I think, was a good athlete as well, and, you know, his teachers liked him. He had friends. And now you suspect that he might have been terribly lonely in one respect.
Yes.
During his school years.
Oddly enough, it was the idea of his high school years that I had the most trouble with because he was so successful. And I think a lot of his energy was driven into being a summa cum laude graduate of his school and a class speaker and a peer counselor. And interestingly enough, his school will not welcome him back. That was very hard. I thought, will people now withdraw their friendship from him? And it's a testament to him. He's a very, well, he's a remarkable person, and his brother is too. It's a testament to both of them that people did not withdraw their friendships from him.
Did you ask yourself if you did anything?
Of course.
That led your son to be gay? Like if you were a domineering mother. Yeah, a suffocating mother. That's a very popular image.
It is, unfortunately, horribly popular. Oh, sure. In fact, I dreamed it. I dreamed that I went into my son's room when he was sleeping. And he was, in my dream, about 8 years old. And I said, I think I forgot to tell you about sex. But it was very clear in my dream that he didn't need to know this. And I agonized about what might I have done. And then I thought, wait, I've only done something wrong if being gay is wrong. And I had never actually believed that being gay was wrong. I'd never thought about it much. And I knew there was nothing wrong about my son. So I guess maybe really only for about 20 minutes did I seriously wonder if it was something I had done. Because once again, when you say if it's something I've done, you're talking about a flaw. And I really never did see him as flawed.
Is there anything you said to your son after he came out that you wished you hadn't said?
Oh, yes. At one point, I was trying to persuade him to tell his brother, who was graduating from high school that year, and Stephen quite rightly said, I don't want to tell Jack now. It will make his graduation all about me. And it's not about me. And it will also make him very uncomfortable, I think. I mean, Stephen was afraid he would lose his brother, maybe. He wasn't sure, but he thought it wasn't the right time to tell him. This made me feel as if we were conspiring against my younger son. And I said, at one point, I was struggling for an analogy, and I came up with possibly the worst analogy I could have come up with. I suddenly said, well, Stephen, this would be like, it would, for Jack, if he hears this from your friends, I mean, it would be as if, and I was still struggling, and I don't know where this came from, and I said, it would be as if he found out you were, a mass murderer. And I've never seen a look on anyone's face that hurt me more than realizing what I had said to my son. And I desperately tried to amend that. But you can't. I don't think Stephen will ever hold that against me. And in fact, even at that moment, I could see him starting to forgive me the minute I said it. And although he was angry, thank God.
Your son told you after he came out that you could ask him any questions and he would answer them. Were there questions that you asked that, in looking back, you shouldn't have, or questions that you wish you asked, but you didn't?
I wish I had immediately asked him, explain to me what this means. Explain to me, is this different? Or do you know if this is different? How can I imagine your life? Because when finally I did ask that question, he said, I don't see. He clearly didn't know this was something that was baffling to me and my husband. So for a long time we didn't quite understand what I was trying to ask. I didn't understand it, and he didn't understand it. And finally he said, you don't have to imagine my life any different than you always imagined it. I want what you want. I want to love somebody who loves me back. I want a committed relationship with someone. I have work I really want to do. I don't understand how people work when their emotional lives are in chaos. I want what you want. I want to love someone who loves me back. That's all I needed to know. But I had bought into the whole idea of, And I say this with some hesitation because I don't know that I really had bought into this idea about any other gay man, only when suddenly it was my own son. Every stereotype I'd ever been faced with hit me, the idea of the insatiability of gay men, which is a ludicrous idea that I had never paid any credence to until it was my own child. I don't know what triggered all these fears.
Rob Foreman-Dew is my guest. Her new book is called The Family Heart, a memoir of when our son came out. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rob Foreman-Dew. Her new book is a memoir about when her son came out. When your reaction switched from a sense of grief to a sense of anger at the inequities in society, you and your husband became activists. You became active in a group of the parents of lesbians and gays. And then you started to think, well, maybe you were becoming activists at the expense of your other son. What happened there?
Well, life is very complicated. I mean, I've discovered it's... You know, Terry, I really thought that I was going to get to a place where it would be very calm to be an adult. I'm 47. I've gone through the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement, and I thought, oh, now I'm here. My children are grown. We suddenly became obsessed with this issue, particularly after the Republican convention and the Pat Buchanan speech and various other speeches and remarks, and we became so obsessed. I was phoning people constantly. I was phoning columnists and saying, you've hurt us deeply. I lost track of my other son, and you can't do that. You owe equal attention to all your children. My other son was also a real advocate for his brother, especially until we became such active advocates. And then I think he had his own life going on. He was starting his first year of college. We simply assumed, which is something I've learned never to do, never assume anything. We assumed he knew that he had our ongoing unconditional love and affection. And he knew that. But he needed to talk to us about some things of his own that had nothing to do with gay and lesbian issues, and we failed him for a while. I think we're all learning constantly. We're coming back together. We are back together.
What happened to make you realize that your other son had felt that you were withdrawing, focusing all of your time on gay rights activism?
Well, it was really an awful moment, and also a transcendent moment and an absurd moment. My son goes to college, my younger son goes to college in Connecticut, and he decided to stay that summer after my older son came out and work in at school. He had been working at Wesleyan, and he decided to stay and live with some friends and work there. And he was back and forth. He called one day. I was trying to get ready for a dinner party. It was very hot and sticky. He called from Connecticut to tell me that he had had a flat tire and that he was at a filling station. And I got very cross. I said, well, Jack, you have my car. You're in Connecticut. What can I do about this? Call AAA. And he said, well, that's why I'm calling. I don't have my AAA card. And I was really very cross. I said, well, how could you leave the house without your AAA card? You know, and he... Just suddenly, there was a sort of intake of breath on his end of the line, and suddenly I could hear traffic going by. And I realized he was calling me from a filling station or somewhere probably on the interstate. And he finally just said, Mom, I almost killed myself when this tire blew. You didn't even ask. If Stephen had called, you would have been worried about him. But you didn't even ask. And then he was talking over tears. I burst into tears, and I asked him to please come home. I said, I'm sorry. There's nothing I can say but that I'm sorry. I'm absolutely wrong, and we love you, and I hope you'll come home this weekend. And he did, and we started building again. This is still a rather sensitive issue. I think Jack probably feels that we're overly paranoid, and we may well be. I think even my older son thinks that maybe we could be a little less activist. But once we got involved with PFLAG and were on the helpline, we're getting some pretty desperate calls from teenagers whose parents have absolutely rejected them. They're homeless. They sometimes have been beaten up by their own parents. And these are children, not children, young men and sometimes young women who easily could have fought back. It's very endangering to an ego of anyone to have a parent attack you physically. And unfortunately, this is often one of the reasons that happens.
It sounds like the family you've created is a reasonably happy family,
mm-hmm.
a reasonably close-knit family. But from what I've read about you, you didn't come from a happy family.
Well, that's true. The family, they were also interesting. The people, my mother and father, were fascinating and quite brilliant. They really weren't very happy married to each other. My father was an alcoholic, which is always a problem, and an entire system of, well, it shapes the family in ways that have now become almost, everyone has been reading about them. But when I was growing up, no one did. This was considered a character flaw. And my father was dangerous when he drank. But I loved both of my parents, and both of my parents loved me. I wanted them to love each other, and I think they sort of did, but they also sort of didn't. It was tiring. I was tired by the time I grew up, and I really thought I would get to rest. Now I don't think I want to rest.
Did growing up in a fairly unhappy family make you more confident that you wanted a family of your own? I mean, you seem so family-oriented now.
I know. I think that's probably... it's probably some sort of psychological term. I think it's compensatory family making. I don't know. No, in fact, I was terrified when I was pregnant. I thought, what am I? I don't know what to do. I have no idea what parents do. But it really is a pretty natural thing. And in fact, my parents were very good. They meant to be very good parents. And for the most part, they really were. They were really hard on each other. And I think it was really hard on my sister and me to see them so unhappy, and we felt like we constantly had to protect them. But I think when I realized what was possible, that it was possible to have emotional stability and really to love people unconditionally, that's when I think my life became bearable. I had really thought often about, I had been in really great despair during part of my life, and had not thought actively about suicide, but had wanted to sleep desperately, and twice had stolen pills from my father, taken them, and luckily they didn't work. I wasn't trying to die, I just wanted to go to sleep because I didn't want to think and have to be responsible or worry or be sad.
You know, you write about families all the time in your fiction, and in one of your novels, a son dies, and it's mm-hmm. you know, obviously really tragic for the family. Did it frighten you to kill off a child in one of your novels? Did you feel like you were tempting fate and something terrible might happen to you in real life as a result?
Absolutely. In fact, I had to wait until my children passed the age of that child before I could finish the book. It was awful to write. And I suppose what I was doing was contemplating my worst fear and trying to understand how people survive having their children die, because I see them do it with grace all the time. And I think I wanted to figure out how.
Did you start behaving differently around your sons when you were writing Fortunate Lives? Did you
yes.
start to... What was the difference?
Well, for one thing, whenever I'm writing, I behave... it's very difficult probably for my family, although they're endlessly patient. But I became so protective or so worried about them all the time. In fact, that was the year my older son had gone off to prep school in New Hampshire, and I was working on this book, and I heard a report that there was a sniper at... I was listening to the radio, and it was horrible. There was a sniper at a college somewhere who had wounded or hurt someone, and I immediately... there were no phones in the dorms where my son was at school. It was a phone in the dorm, but you could never get it. So I left a call and asked him to leave an urgent message for Stephen to call me. And he called, and I said, Stephen, you absolutely must come home if you hear there's a sniper on campus. And he was just, he said, well, okay, I will. I mean, I was just sort of a madwoman about safety. I mean, I was constantly telling them things like, how to exit buildings if fire started. And I think they were so glad when I was through with that book. And, you know, they both read it, and they both like it. I don't think they quite understand the passion of parents.
You have a passage in your new memoir that I found both very moving and kind of funny, too. And you're talking about all the superstitions and rituals parents will go through when they feel that their child might be in jeopardy to kind of do right by fate.
That's right.
And your example is of a friend who, whenever her child is on a plane coming home from a visit with his father on the opposite coast, what does she do?
She scrubs her entire house. And I know just exactly, she's
what's the point of scrubbing
parent.
The house?
Well, if she has any fun while her children are in the air, I know she feels that somehow they'll take her children away from, the plane will crash. Because how dare she have fun while her children are in jeopardy? Now, her children are getting older, too. All of us do this. I'm sort of starting to grow out of it.
What do you do?
Well, what I do is wear my opal earrings, which I have on right now, actually. Because one of my children is traveling right now. They're really not even pretty. But my children I was born in October, so opals are lucky for October. I mean, of course they're not lucky. It's a superstition, and of course I'm not superstitious, but I'm wearing these opals. I wear these whenever. I've sort of extended it now. It's not just my children. Anybody I love or care about who's traveling, I put on these opal earrings, which when a friend of mine recently flew to Australia was really painful because they're not comfortable to sleep in. But they work. The planes haven't crashed. So I should knock wood now.
Right? So you have to sleep in them, too, how to make this work.
Yes, you can't let yourself off the hook. If you're going to be superstitious, you've got to sort of follow through with it. But, of course, I mean, we all know, all of the parents, my friend who's scrubbing her garbage cans with bleach knows that on some level, because she's a brilliant woman, she knows that is not going to keep this plane in the air. But on the other hand, she's not going to take any chances.
Your children are adults now. Do you still feel that it's? Do you still feel as scared and superstitious about their safety?
No, that really does wear. That wears off after a while. When you see them being competent adults, and they certainly have been competent adults, the idea of your responsibility for their happiness wears off, and in fact, you come together as good friends in a way that I hadn't known would happen. When now that they're responsible and leading lives that I admire and that seem exciting to me, I don't feel quite, although I do have these opal earrings on, don't I? But even so, I don't feel quite as responsible.
Rob Forman-Dew, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It was a delight.
Rob Forman-Dew has written a new book called The Family Heart, a memoir of when our son came out. I'm Cherie Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What makes a good leader? Is Bill Clinton one? Coming up, we talk with Gary Wills about his new book, Certain Trumpets, The Call of Leaders. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his previous book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Crooklyn, Spike Lee's new movie about a family in Brooklyn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We often hear that we're suffering from a shortage of good leaders. Gary Will says we have many good leaders, but they're not necessarily in electoral politics. Some of our best recent leaders, he says, have been in the civil rights movement, the women's movement, business, and religion. Wills analyzes different leadership styles in his new book, Certain Trumpets, The Call of Leaders. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his previous book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. I asked Wills about President Clinton's leadership style. Wills says, as a governor, Clinton had to be very accommodating to the legislature to push his bills through. In national government, he may be too anxious to please his enemies.
It's very useful to a leader, a political leader, often, to have the right enemies. Take Richard Nixon. Now, here's a man who is not tremendously warm or likable in himself, but he had very loyal followers, and many of those were followers because of the enemies he had made. They followed him less because they thought Richard Nixon was warm and wonderful and ideal than because they thought that demonstrators in the street were tearing down the society and he was able to stand up to them, willing to stand up to them, snarl back at them. So even his meanness or his mean streak that came out at times was something that some of those followers treasured. They thought, well, he won't put up with these rioters, these demonstrators, these anti-war peaceniks. So choosing your enemies and using them well is a gift that politicians often have to have. And Bill Clinton doesn't seem to want to have any enemy.
And you think that's getting in his way?
I think it will, or may in the future, yeah.
In your new book, there's a chapter about Eleanor Roosevelt, and you describe her as a reform-oriented leader. How would you compare Eleanor Roosevelt to Hillary Clinton as first ladies?
Well, again, there's a work in progress in the case of Hillary Clinton. In some ways, Eleanor Roosevelt was more outrageous and got away with more. For instance, she insisted on being paid for everything she wrote as the president's wife. And not only that, she ran a radio show which had commercial sponsors. Now you would never get away with that, it seems to me. On the other hand, she was very cautious about anything that might embarrass her husband. For instance, everybody knows that she protested the DAR's exclusion of Marian Anderson from their hall. But when Marian Anderson went on to give her concert at the Lincoln Memorial, Eleanor, at the request of Lewis Howe, did not go. Howe said this would be going too far and it would embarrass Franklin. So she didn't do it. And in other cases, she would trim and hedge. And I don't think that was wrong in her case. It would do her no good to damage her husband so that he couldn't be reelected, for instance. It would do no good to her causes. So that's one of the points of my book, that there is not one ideal of leadership, that you don't have to have hard principle, refusal to compromise as the only kind of leadership. It's one kind, and a very important kind, but there are other kinds.
Compare Eleanor Roosevelt to Hillary Clinton.
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt was very bright and self-taught, but she was unhappy about her lack of formal education. She went to finishing school rather than normal kinds of college, and she always felt that she was not as educated as some of her associates and as she wished. And that made her, in some ways, less confident about herself. And it made her trim to an unnecessary degree. For instance, she would disclaim ability to talk about policy. She did finally get around to doing it in various ways, but she could have done it without that disclaimer if she'd had a little more self-confidence. The times are different now. Not only is Hillary Clinton trained, educated, very well educated as a lawyer, she had a professional career and standing on her own. Now, Eleanor Roosevelt was a professional in some ways. She was a writer, she was a teacher before she became the president's wife. But she didn't have a professional training or status, and she didn't have a women's movement that had reached the condition that the one has now, where not only Hillary Clinton, but most of the candidates who are coming along now have professional wives. A number of the presidential candidates running last time out had lawyer wives. So she's not a unique phenomenon. She's not alone in the way that Eleanor was.
You use Ross Perot as your example of a good business leader. Why did you use Ross Perot to epitomize good business leadership?
Because he's in the great tradition of salesmanship, which is glorified by our business tradition. The entrepreneur who not only can invent something, lots of people can do that, but who can go out and sell it. Henry Ford was not only good at tinkering in his shop, but even better at coming up with sales gimmickry. So most of our business heroes have been people in the sales department. He knows how to dramatize himself and his product and his workers, and he commanded tremendous loyalty among his original workers, his EDS workers, before he sold them. So as a mobilizer, both of people to sell his product and of buyers to buy it, he was spectacular. So I treat him in that career. I don't treat him in the political career, because that's a different type that other people exemplify better.
I think as part of the preparation for your book, you spent some time in bookstores in the business section looking at the inspirational books on how to become a great business leader. Did you learn anything interesting by looking at these books?
Well, I learned the vulnerability of people in business, because almost all of them are therapeutic. They encourage, they say, don't get discouraged, don't worry if people won't respond to you, because after all, salespeople and people who are pushing a product get rejected and turned down. Fewer people buy the product than say, no, I won't buy it, no matter how good the product is. So a lot of it is simply hand-holding, and the better business people have understood that and have created morale by a kind of group psyching up, you know, these annual sales conferences and rewards and team projects and sales courses in which you learn how to overcome resistance and rejection.
You know, there's a book coming out in the spring or the fall that will be called Jesus Christ CEO. That will have lessons for business leaders about what they can learn from Christ's life.
Well, you know, what we know from Christ's life is a very distant report. And even in those reports, namely the Gospels written by his disciples a fair amount of time after his death, even those reports make him out to be a failure during his life, so he's hardly a model of success. He was rejected, he was humiliated, he was killed, and even his followers fled from him, and they write that down themselves. So he's a mysterious theological event, and if you are a believer in him, as I am, by the way, I'm a Catholic, you believe that he failed in his life and he succeeded after death by entirely supernatural means. So I wouldn't take him as a model.
Gary Wills is my guest. His new book about leadership is called Certain Trumpets. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about leadership with Gary Wills. You write that intellectual leaders are very rare. Now, why are they so rare?
Well, because there's something in the intellectual life that tends towards solitude, toward thinking, toward following a line of thought no matter where it takes you. And The more refined and rarefied your thinking becomes, the harder it is to communicate it just at random to lots of people. So the truly innovative thinker, the David Hume in his thought, the Plato, these are people who tend to become isolated from followers, and then popularizers come along who take their thought when it's less original, when it's been absorbed by some followers, and they tend to popularize it, and those are the intellectual leaders. So William Buckley, who takes conservative thought and tries to get people to mobilize to vote for the Republican Party because of some kind of principled intellectual position, he's a leader. But some of his sources were not leaders, although they were great thinkers.
You know, in your book, you try to sort out the different types of leaders that we have and the different leadership styles that they use. And you say that there's a very old belief that democracy is actually incompatible with good leadership. Would you explain that seeming contradiction?
Well, yes. If the people make their own decisions, as one view of democracy is, and the elected representative just carries out those decisions, then, of course, the people are not being led. They are leading their leaders, in effect. They're giving orders to the person who is their representative. That's a simplistic view of democracy, as I say, but it's one that's often brought up, that if a leader is simply following what the people say, he can't be leading. Of course, the dialogue is much more complex because the people don't really say what they think should be done. There's not a machinery that makes that possible. Political theory has long explored the fact that you can't pose a question in such a way that a simple yes or no will represent what people actually think about it. If you say, for instance, should we go to war in Haiti, and you have people vote on that, well, some of those who say we should would say it under such complex conditions that it would be impossible to carry out and carry along with you some of the other people who had voted for that. So a leader in a democracy has to reframe the questions and ask people again what they think in various ways and try to lead them by framing the question in answerable ways. For instance, Abraham Lincoln knew that he could not simply propose to the electorate, should we free the slaves? He would be rejected. So he found ways of saying, well, should slaves be equal? And they would say, no, I don't want to be, should blacks be equal? And then he would say, well, what happens, though, to the Declaration of Independence, which says all men are created equal? And they say, well, in a way, that's true. And so he built on that. And he said, well, I'm not after social equality. I'm at least saying one man should not own another man. Would you say that's something that would fit under the Declaration of Independence? So he was reframing the question in ways that he could get some kind of an answer that would move him along the way toward emancipation. So that's the kind of dialogue that goes on. And, of course, he has to be paying very close attention to them and knowing what he can get them to respond to and what he can't.
Dan Quayle has a new book out and is traveling around the country using that as an opportunity to, I think, try to present a different image of himself. How would you describe him as a leader?
Well, we had very little opportunity to know because his own administration kept him under wraps most of the time, which is what he complains about in his book, apparently. I haven't read it yet. As a senator, he was not bad. And, you know, people forget that he won his debates when he ran for Congress and when he ran for the Senate. And the Senate debate was against Birch Bayh, a formidable opponent. So perhaps we saw a different Dan Quayle in the national arena the first time around.
Bob Dole would perhaps like to be the next president. Your thoughts on him?
Well, he's not very successful in going out and meeting large groups of people. I think he's obviously a legislative leader and very good at that, respected, hardworking. But his skills in meeting and attracting audiences in the broader arena are still untested, I think.
So those are two really different kinds of leadership.
Sure.
The
sure.
type to mobilize
at,
the public.
At, look at Lyndon Johnson as a legislative leader and Lyndon Johnson as a president. It shows the difference in the kinds of leadership that were entailed.
In thinking about what we want from our leaders, on the one hand, we want them to be behind to be in their offices making important decisions all the time. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, they need to be mobilizing popular support and everything. Sometimes I turn on C-SPAN and Warren Christopher's on all the time, or Bill Clinton's making a speech every day, and I wonder, how do they get anything done?
Well, it is a trade-off. You have to do your homework, but you also have to keep the people informed and responsive and interested. It's a difficult task. One of the funny things is that Franklin Roosevelt was very good at that because, in a way, he was so immobilized that he had to think up ways to reach out to people without having to get out of the office and get out of his chair and get out from behind his desk. So he tailored his press conferences and his fireside chats and his appearances to a kind of economy of what can I do to get the most public response for the least amount of physical exertion, because I'm not up to a lot of physical exertion. And maybe presidents should think more in those terms, that because they're able to jump on Air Force One and go wherever they want anytime they want, they probably tend to do it too much.
Mm-hmm. After Nixon died, you had an op-ed piece, and I think it was the New York Times, in which you described Nixon as a small, bitter man and a very grand diplomat, you know, mm-hmm. trying to point out the paradoxes of Nixon's personality as a leader. I'm sure you watched a lot of the funeral coverage and the speeches afterwards and so on. Do you think there was a lot of rewriting of Nixon as,
yes.
as a leader and a person? I just wonder what went through your mind watching everything that was said and written about him after his death.
Well, I think it was his last trick. Really, he was proving himself a resurrectionist again. What's fascinating about Nixon is that he engaged people so deeply, so emotionally, in hatred or pity or responses of solidarity with him, that there's always been a kind of volatility and emotional lightning atmosphere around him. And I think that came out, that people over-responded to the fact that he was dead and couldn't be kicked around anymore. So instead of kicking him around, they cosseted him around. There's already been a reaction to that. He will never lie at rest as something distant from us as long as those of us who lived through his time are alive and our emotions are still engaged.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gary Will's new book is called Certain Trumpets, The Call of Leaders. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, the Senate today has voted both ways on sending arms into Bosnia. They voted to lift the embargo, but then they also voted not to lift the embargo and to work with the United Nations on what to do next. I'm not sure how that's supposed to come out, but we'll have a report. The city of Kigali appears to be falling to rebel forces in Rwanda. We'll talk to people who are opposed to abortion about the recent setbacks that they have had and what they think they are going to do now as we contemplate a new member of the Supreme Court. And we're continuing with our Culture Wars series. This one is on family values. We'll talk to two Christian families about the values they want to pass on.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Spike Lee likes to call his films joints, as in a Spike Lee joint. But his latest picture might be called a Lee family joint. It was co-written by Lee's sister Joa and brother Sankey, and it's about a Brooklyn family whose father is a struggling jazz musician, like Lee's father, Bill. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Crooklyn.
For my money, Spike Lee has always been a second-rate filmmaker living in the body of a first-rate self-promoter. Ever since he emerged with the clever but spotty She's Gotta Have It, Spike has managed to get himself hailed as a master, even though his movie-making and storytelling skills have never got beyond the level of a bright film school student. And Crooklyn is a case in point. It's not that this movie isn't sometimes charming. It is. Spike and his siblings have set their story mostly on a single Brooklyn block in the halcyon early 70s. In those days, kids played stickball and sang on the stoop. A neighborhood drug problem meant that those two sleepy guys across the street, one of them played by Spike Lee, were sniffing glue again. And an outburst of violence was likely to be a yelling match between you and your neighbor over how bad his poodle smelled. Yelling, in fact, is mostly what this movie is about. The Carmichael family lives in a big, beautiful brownstone, and what they do in it is yell at each other. The five kids yell about having to eat black-eyed peas and not getting to watch television. The eldest child, 10-year-old Troy, played by a touching 8-year-old actress named Zelda Harris, yells at her four brothers because they taunt her. Their mother, played by Alfred Woodard, yells at their father because he's a jazz musician who can't seem to bring home a paycheck. And the father, beautifully played by Delroy Lindo, well, he mainly makes mushy speeches like this one to his daughter, Troy.
Troy, your father saw you about last night.
It's not your fault, Daddy.
You know, Daddy doesn't want to fight or yell or scream or holler. All Daddy wants to do is play his music. That's all.
Well, maybe if you played other people's music, Mommy wouldn't scream and yell at you.
I can't do that anymore, Troy. I got to work on my music now.
Well, maybe you should just go for taking her out on a date.
Think so, huh?
I do.
The movie meanders, dips in and out of one vignette after another, and in the end never finds a focus. Lee hasn't invented a story or even an arc of character development to glue the bits and pieces together. In fact, the only glue in this movie, besides the stuff at the bottom of the bag Lee keeps sniffing, is the 70s music, which Lee swirls over everything like so much frosting, obscuring the goings-on underneath. There's a pointless episode in the middle of the film in which Troy takes a summer vacation with her bourgeois relatives in the South. And in order to register the poor girl's sense of dislocation, Spike shoots the whole sequence using a lens that squeezes all the characters like stick figures. This wouldn't be so bad for a shot or two, but the segment is long and complicated, and after a while your eyes start to fume in protest. Shooting it that way is the sort of pretentious distraction that most professional movie makers would have given up after film school. But Spike Lee's fame and power developed so quickly that he never had time to mature as a filmmaker. And he never had anyone around to tell him when what he was doing was juvenile, incoherent, or slack. Watching Crooklyn, you understand why, back in the good old days, for every director who was an 800-pound gorilla, there was always a producer who was a 900-pound gorilla.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reif, Ann Neville, and Philo Holland are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with actor Peter Coyote. He's currently starring in Roman Polanski's Bitter Moon and Pedro Almodovar's new movie Kika. In the 60s, Coyote was involved with the Diggers, a radical group in San Francisco that performed street theater and ran a free store. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.